Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson.
Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good. I thought I lost it there for a second. You there?
I'm still here. I was waiting. I thought that pause was, I know you're going to try to do that sort of, I almost want to call it a Dan Ratherism. That kind of dates me, obviously, but some kind of a folksy type.
Well, sort of like a Norm Peterson sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like in, you know,
I get it. Yeah. Some kind of
cheers.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. Again, we're dating ourselves, but
At least I'm not that clever. I'm not that clever on a Saturday morning.
So. No, that I think that's probably it. Absolutely. So anyway, well, let's get right to it. Greetings aside. So I thought the obvious place to start today would be with the further escalation in the trade war between the United States and China. To kind of bring everything up to date, late last week, of course, U.S. tariffs of $200 billion on Chinese goods jumped from 10 to 25%. And then in addition, President Trump is now considering imposing tariffs on another $300 billion in Chinese imports. And this came, of course, amid the failure of what really both sides expected to be a major agreement. And the U.S. position here is that there was, in fact, an agreement in principle, but the Chinese backed out at the last minute, maybe due to pressure from some hardliners in China who were opposed to those concessions on intellectual property and state-sponsored industries. And then, of course, kind of this other aspect in here is the Trump administration putting the Chinese tech company Huawei on its so-called death list, which essentially bans U.S. companies from selling to Huawei without a specifically authorized exemption. And this is possible because of President Trump's earlier this week declaration of a national emergency in which, as his statement puts it, foreign adversaries are increasingly creating and exploiting vulnerabilities in information and communication technology and services in a way that constitutes an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States. And in response to all this, China announced plans to impose tariffs on $60 billion in U.S. imports. And so the upshot seems to be, well, markets reacted not so favorably, and as well as a number of Republicans in Congress who are, you know, I think getting more concerned about the situation, especially in regards to farmers who are the ones who are most likely to really feel these effects of tariffs most directly and
most
strongly.
Immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so kind of in response to that, the administration is putting together an aid package of up to $20 billion in direct payments to farmers hurt by tariffs. And that's kind of modeled after the $12 billion program they put in place in 2018. So I think that kind of brings us up to speed. So Jay, what do you think about the latest in all this?
Which is in some ways kind of modeled off of the Chinese model of subsidized industry.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think about what's happened in the last week here?
Well, you skipped the good news in that it sounds as if we have reached a sort of complete agreement with Canada and Mexico.
Right.
On getting rid of the steel tariffs that had had been scheduled to go in place. But setting that aside, I mean, we have talked about this forever, and you know that I am in my heart a free trader. And the question is, you know, is this the method to get to a freer trade? Because I think the idea, the biggest issue to my mind, I think to a lot of U.S. companies, it's not this, you know, China can produce it cheaper or something like that. It is the intellectual property issue, and that is something that's sort of unique that we're dealing with China. And there's national security pieces that kind of go along with that, right? I mean, and the rule very briefly is typically China requires, if you're going to be doing business in China, that you essentially open a joint venture with a Chinese company, which is typically also the Chinese state, which means that if you are a tech company or have some sort of intellectual property, you are sort of giving that away to a Chinese company when you choose to do business with China. And that's a tremendous problem. And I think that's a problem that is long term. It's not tenable. I'm not in favor of a trade war. This is at least has the virtue of not being tried yet. And we'll see if the Chinese eventually sort of fold. And it sounded like they were close on that issue. I'm sort of stumbling here because there's a lot I don't know, right? I mean, as far as what's going on behind the scenes, the markets, I mean, yeah, did drop, but not precipitously. So I think the sense that I get from the markets is that they anticipate there will be a resolution. It might not be as quick as had been hoped for.
Yeah.
Well, so I guess that's my kind of uptake is, from the Adam Smith, old school conservatism, type view, tariffs are a bad thing. If this is being used in service of eventually having a flatter, more level playing field, then maybe they serve their purpose. But it just remains to be seen.
Yeah, well, you know, something that President Trump reportedly said is, and this was in one of these anonymous sources, private conversation kind of thing, but he said, unless we stand up now, there's not going to be a chance to do it in the future. And I get the sentiment, and I actually agree with it to a certain extent. And I think, you know, something that a lot of people have been saying as well, it almost might be a little bit too late now, and that the time to deal with China from a position of strength would have been, 10 years ago or something like that. But I think kind of in response, not necessarily disagreeing with that, but it's important to kind of look back at the history a little bit here, kind of understand this. You know, China was admitted to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in December of 2001. And if you take a look at China's GDP, it basically rises kind of like a hockey stick, essentially like a kind of a J curve from the mid 2000s on. I mean, their average GDP growth from 2001 through 2017 over 9%, which is enormous, obviously. And the bet that we and the rest of the really international kind of community were making was that, well, as China prospered economically, they liberalized in a lot of other ways. And actually, to a certain extent, that kind of happened for a while. But certainly when Xi Jinping came into power in 2013, we started to see that changing, I think, in a certain way. And so, you know, I don't necessarily know that that's still a bad bet. I mean, if you look back even further to the 1980s, Japan and South Korea were both accused of technology theft and that sort of thing, the kind of stuff that China is doing right now. But what we found is that, well, as their per capita GDP started to rise, they started to see the calculus a little bit differently, and they shifted to becoming what we would consider, better players in the international community. And so one estimate put that number at where that shift really started to happen was $25,000 per person. Now, China's currently at $16,700 per person. So it would still be a little while. So there's one argument to say, this is being over-dramatized and we just need to be patient. I'm not entirely convinced by that argument because I think there's a difference in scale here that concerns me. So there's that, but I think there's this natural tendency to overreact to these things, which is not to say that there isn't a potential threat. I certainly think there is one.
Potential threat from economic threat from
economic
from the sanction from the problems of a trade war or from the continuation of the status quo with China.
I think both actually, you know. Yeah. But I think that the trade war, to me, the longer term concern is the status quo, especially in terms of the security issues. And so, you know, if you're going to be sanguine about it, you just say, well, you know, it worked out with China with Japan and South Korea. It'll probably work out with China. I'm a little less comfortable about that. But
right,
I think another
you're dealing with two, you know, Japan and South Korea have what we would call liberal democratic governments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, though, you know, I think while I sympathize and to a certain extent agree with President Trump in the national security and so forth. And that's why I think even though, you know, pushing Huawei like this seems extreme, given their position in networking technologies, especially future like 5G networking technologies, I think that's not unreasonable. But I disagree with his approach. You know, for instance, I think that we just don't have the clout anymore to deal with China in this way, to press them unilaterally. One thing I think we definitely made a huge mistake in doing is pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, I think we should have worked way harder to stick in there and to give, you know, to give China sort of a carrot more than just these threats of sticks. And in fact, there was there's a great report on sort of the advantages, what the advantages would have been of sticking into the TPP. In fact, just currently, because the TPP is still a thing, the countries currently in it without the U.S. have a GDP nearly equal to that of China. And there are just a ton of benefits we're not getting by pulling out of that. There's a great paper on this I came across from the Senate's Republican Policy Committee, and it really outlines a lot of this stuff. And in fact, I'll put a link up to this in the show notes. I thought it was really a really useful way to look at this. And again, so while I agree with President Trump that, yeah, we need to do something and act more forcefully, the way to do it is not unilaterally. The way to do it is multilaterally, I think.
I wouldn't disagree with you on that. I mean, the TPP, I'm all for that. And again, that goes to sort of the more traditional conservative view of international economics. Yeah. Maybe that was the case, and I think maybe the TPP and U.S. sort of reevaluating its position as to that. Could put a little extra pressure on China, but I wouldn't discount the adverse effect that the sanctions can have on China. It's and this is what Trump is betting on, is that look, it's going to hurt both countries, but it's going to hurt them more and hurt them faster.
I think that's a bad bet. Well, the reason why I think that's a bad bet is because if you look at the sort of pain that China's government has been able to impose on its people without any, you know, without any kind of ramifications. Sure. I mean, they forced a lot of austerity on people to achieve certain political ends, whereas we just don't have a political system that's designed to do that. So I think, you know, you could argue maybe we're economically in the long term, the U.S. might be in a better position to impose this, but politically, and that's the important thing, we're not in a better position, because eventually if things go too far, even the president's own, you know, Republican Party members are going to start abandoning him on this. And we're seeing, you know, some signs of this certainly even now. And as that pressure gets greater and greater, the political will is just not going to be there in the United States, whereas it will be there in China.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, when the political will is sort of, you know, more or less one guy.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of Yeah, you know, and my other concern on this, Jay, is that the tariffs, when they really start hitting, and it's going to be a while before consumers really feel the hit from that. But of course, tariffs aren't just taxes; they're regressive taxes. You know, meaning that, you know, obviously the poorest people are going to have the greatest hit. And I think it's great that they're trying to do something to kind of insulate farmers from this, certainly. But, you know, a lot of people are going to feel the hit. You think about everything that's manufactured or assembled in China, and you go from 10 to 25% on that. There's no way that manufacturers can basically just eat those costs. They have to pass those costs along to consumers.
Yeah, or I mean, in some cases, if they're able to manufacture somewhere else, they can do that.
And
that,
but of course, there are costs. There are huge costs.
And that's not something you can just do on a dime, obviously. Yeah. So.
And even so, even if they were thinking about that, then there's the consideration of, well, how long will this be in effect? And do we want to start changing up our supply chains when maybe in a couple of years? So
we can hold, well, if you can just hold out, you know, a couple more months.
Exactly.
Trump's. He had made the statement at some point last week when it was sort of on again, off again, that, you know, he sees this is going to get done. This is going to get over. And I think he's right, because I think the way Donald Trump operates is he gets to a point where he's going to try to make the best deal he can get or try to get, you know, the absolute best deal. And then, you know, eventually retreat to the best deal he can get and then take it.
Well, we'll
and I think, I think that's how this ends up. So,
I hope you're right. You have maybe a little more faith in the president's negotiating savvy than I do, but we'll see. You know, the one other, before we move on, the other part I wanted to mention about this is the trade deficit issue, which really, in the past, certainly, President Trump has hammered on a lot. Now, it seems like he's moving a little bit more to focus on the security issues, which I think is right, because I think what a lot of people, especially maybe the president, don't seem to grasp is that, you know, the trade deficit is much more about the fact that we don't save a whole lot and we spend a ton. And so it's not like if we change things with China, the trade deficit would go away. It might shift to other countries and so forth, you know, and this isn't just me talking. This is a lot of economists would say that. In fact, there was, you know, Martin Feldstein, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Ronald Reagan, basically said, you know, this is just kind of nuts, this focus on that, because the problem is fundamentally that we're spending way too much and we're not saving nearly enough. And that's not going to change with any kind of a deal with China.
Right. Well, and you could, and I think Feldstein's right. But I wouldn't say it's necessarily, well, we're spending too much, but we're spending more and we have more to spend.
How?
If you follow.
Oh, well, I mean, ultimately, if we're spending more than we have to borrow that money. It comes from somewhere else, and we spend a lot.
Oh,
more.
Are you talking government spending or consumer spending?
No, consumer spending.
I thought you were talking consumer spending.
I am talking consumer spending. Yeah.
Well, but with consumer spending, again, we've got a lot more income to spend than say the average person in China does, and we have a strong dollar, which means we can buy more from overseas at a lower cost. Now, I'm with you. I've never seen trade deficits as again. This is a wonderful sort of, we're agreeing on
pretty much
classic,
everything. I think we're
Adam
agreeing here. Yeah.
Kind of stuff, yeah. Right? I might disagree with the difference of, well, it's because we have a trade deficit because we're not saving enough. Other than that, I think that analysis is right on. I mean, a trade deficit in and of itself shouldn't be cause for alarm, or shouldn't be cause for change for public policy. The security stuff and the protecting intellectual property of American companies, I think, is, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, you know, as you said, trade is one of these issues that you and I tend to be almost in lockstep on, I would say. So as opposed to some other things, like, I don't know if this is going to be one of those things, but of course, moving to domestic politics this week, Alabama's Republican Governor Kay Ivey signed into law the most restrictive anti-abortion legislation in the United States. The new law bans abortions in all cases when a woman is known to be pregnant, making exception only for cases of serious health risk to the prospective mother. Now, there was a Democratic amendment that would have added in a rape and incest exception, and that actually failed 21-11 in the state Senate.
Yeah. And
the penalty for providing an abortion under the law would be, you know, pretty severe, with up to a 99-year prison sentence. Now, of course, Alabama, like a number of other states that have passed similar bans, they know that these laws are not constitutionally permissible at present, but they've passed them specifically to provide the Supreme Court with an opportunity to overturn Roe versus Wade. And, you know, I went back this week to actual text of Roe versus Wade, and there's one passage in particular I thought was important. Justice Blackmun, who authored the majority opinion, at one point wrote, the Pelley and certain amici argue that the fetus is a person within the language and meaning of the 14th Amendment. In support of this, they outline at length and in detail the well-known facts of fetal development. If this suggestion of personhood is established, the appellant's case, of course, collapses. And then Blackmun went on to state that all this, together with our observation that throughout the major portion of the 19th century, prevailing legal abortion practices were far freer than they are today, persuades us that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, does not include the unborn. And so I mm-hmm. thought that was, you know, particularly relevant. So, Jay, what do you think about Alabama's law? I mean, I guess in a couple of ways, particularly, what sort of a test case it might provide the Supreme Court? And of course, the big question that a lot of people are talking about this week, if you expect this court to eventually overturn Roe versus Wade.
So I'll tell you, the Alabama law is written in such a way, and there was some really interesting stuff that I've read on this. You know, there are sort of two schools of thought in the right to life movement, and one is the incremental approach. The other is the go for broke, and this is sort of the go for broke. But they're doing it in sort of a different way, and keying off that what you just read from Justice Blackmun, because if you hadn't said that, I would. I probably wouldn't have had the whole quote handy, but the idea that Alabama, what their legal theory is, they're not just saying we are prohibiting abortion because we want to prohibit abortion. The bill, as signed into law now, recognizes personhood of right. Of a fetus, and so their argument is going to be: look, Justice Blackmun, he looked back and said, "There's nothing we can find where the 14th Amendment has been interpreted to be a person, or a fetus has been interpreted to be a person for the purposes of the 14th Amendment." But historically, we don't find any precedent for that. But does the state have a right then to establish that personhood? Right? I mean, there's also yeah. The idea under the Constitution that, even if you don't have a federal right, states can still recognize, you know, beyond that, that's, you know, the Constitution is a floor, not a ceiling.
And that's why I think, at least following that logic, while Alabama really couldn't include rape or incest exceptions, because then the logic falls apart. Either a fetus is a person or it's not. And if it's a person, well, you don't get to kill that person in this kind of logic just because that person yes. happened to be the result of rape or incest. Now, the health risk to the mother is different because then you're weighing the life of another person. And so then you have that kind of balancing test. So, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that logic, but I understand it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And I think this is, I mean, as far as will Roe versus Wade be overturned? That I still think there would be tremendous reluctance,
yeah,
from John Roberts to do that. I think there would be reluctance even amongst, if you want to say the real conservative, wing, to do that without at least on a 5-4 ruling.
Yeah.
I think when and if Roe versus Wade gets overturned, it needs to be much more than a 5-4 ruling. So I'm not sure. And again, we've got probably a couple years till this actually percolates its way up to the Supreme Court.
But before this one does, of course, I mean, there are some other cases as well. I think there's another Alabama case from 2016, pills. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the court could act more quickly than this. And so some people are saying, well, why is Alabama doing this right now if, as a test case, if there are already other test cases? And of course, part of it is, you know, playing to your base.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, this is something that, again, when you say Alabama, I mean, what we're talking about are the people of Alabama and the representatives they elected.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, so that's the thing of, it's a democratic sort of, that's what the people want. And, I think this is, it's going to be interesting to see what the courts do with this. Because again, the idea of expanding personhood is sort of a novel approach to it.
And I think, you know, your point about the reluctance, especially among someone like John Roberts, to have this be a 5-4 decision is an important thing. You know, Roe was a 7-2 decision. And so certainly I think that's an important thing to bring up. But let's say that did happen, that they did, or they will eventually overturn it. Of course, this wouldn't make abortion illegal, but it would lead to, well, it would leave it up to the states then, essentially. And, right. You know, if that happened, this actually, you could make an argument, would be to the long-term economic detriment of the states that have rather draconian anti-abortion laws. I mean, because there are, I can think there would be plenty of men and women who want contraceptive options, who would be a lot less likely to move to states or to stay in states that wouldn't give them that right to do that. You know, I mean, so I think,
well, I think they have plenty of, they have, well, I'll quibble a little with the, I think they have plenty of contraceptive options, even in Alabama.
I mean, right now, if this goes through, the only post-sexual activity contraceptive option would be the Plan B pill, basically, you know? And so, but that would be
the word contraceptive, but
right. Well, and you know,
is,
go ahead.
It is embodied in the word of like pre conception.
I see what you're saying. Right. Now, there is an argument, an interesting argument from the left, well, at least some parts of the left, that Roe versus Wade was actually a pretty much, aside from in the area of reproductive rights, which is hugely important, actually has been an impediment to progressive politics in a lot of areas. Again, outside of reproductive rights.
How so?
So basically, by energizing, you know, what became the religious right, that have kind of provided the votes to elect a lot of Republican politicians, of course, including Donald Trump, who have basically pushed for what we on the left would definitely say are incredibly regressive policies kind of across the board. Now, I'm not saying that wasn't, you know, worth the trade-off, but, you know, it's an interesting argument. And certainly if you didn't have those pro-life voices, say, you know, voting for Donald Trump, I think there's a good chance that Donald Trump, you know, isn't president of the United States. But of course, you know, just wanted to kind of throw that out there.
A possibility, but I think those pro-life voices would have still voted for someone other than Hillary Clinton.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I think the argument is essentially that once you kind of make it a, well, we need the judges on the court to overturn Roe, but if you take that argument away, then all of a sudden that drains some of the energy because really...
Oh, exactly. No, there are plenty of Republicans and who think that Trump is noxious, but he'll appoint good judges, and they're willing to live with that trade-off. Yeah. And I would say that the counterpoint to your argument would be that... it's the left that sort of put the courts into play, right? In the first place.
The left, that last part, I wanted to get some clarification on. It's the left.
Well, the idea that Roe versus, and I guess this is just sort of the flip side of what you're arguing. If there hadn't been an activist judiciary, and I think you and I sometimes differ on when we talk about a judicial activism, but I think we would agree that regardless of where you want to come out on the merits, Roe was judicial activism, right?
Well, in what sense?
In that it created a new right that had not been found before.
Well, I wouldn't go.
It had not been legislatively established. That was really not found in precedent. They sort of stretched precedent to say, well, it sort of emanates from the various penumbras of other rights, which were sort of penumbral in the first place.
I know that's the standard position on the right. I disagree with that to a certain extent. I would say that certainly dating back to, you know, even pre-constitutional common law, there's an established, very well-established right to privacy. And the argument from the left, and one that I have a lot of sympathy for, is that kind of one of the most fundamental parts of the right to privacy is essentially the right for government not to tell you what you can and cannot do with your own body. And so I think that that's a natural, logical connection to the right to privacy. And yeah, the word privacy does not appear anywhere in the Constitution, but I think that's pretty well established. And so I don't see it as nearly as much of a stretch as you do.
Okay. Well, I'm talking federal constitution versus what states could do. But I think there's something else that I think is fascinating in that certain states, New York among them, have also sort of taken this approach of, well, Roe is going to be undone, so we're going to take preemptive approaches, right, and sort of establish a positive right to abortion, much as Alabama is sort of trying to establish a positive right to personhood. And I think the arguments are fascinating just from the political sense, because you then fall into those areas where they believe the governor of Virginia sort of stepped in it on these very questions, because it becomes the establishing the positive right to abortion, I think, is the tougher uphill battle politically than the right to personhood.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying. At
least you start getting it because you necessarily in those cases, in drawing up the legislation, you have to say a person does not exist and up through and including, you know, during birth even. So I just think that's an interesting dynamic. I'm not arguing one way or the other, but I think it's sort of healthy, right? Well, to argue that on both sides and at the legislative level rather than the courts.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I don't entirely agree, but I do agree that certainly as a general rule, it's better for the legitimacy of decisions when they are reached through the democratic process rather than through the courts. Though I think the kind of a countervailing factor is there are certain fundamental rights that shouldn't be legislated through the democratic process, and that's because they are in fact fundamental rights,
right.
You know, and so I think there's a good case to be made that the right for a woman to do what she wants with her body is a fundamental right, and so that's where you and I would say probably part company on this one.
Yeah, I think so. Well, again, it's we'll see what the courts do, because this is going to present a different kind of look at it.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I don't really think, at least in the next couple of years, that Roe will be overturned in its entirety. I see more kind of a gradual chipping away thing. Now, of course, if
or sort of a Casey approach, because I mean, there's a big argument. It's not a frivolous argument that Roe has really sort of already been overturned.
Well, at least
in the way the framework that it uses.
Right. So I guess that would change. I would think the calculus changes if Donald Trump gets one or two more appointees to the court. And, you know, that could potentially happen, obviously. But given the current court, I don't see it happening, at least in the next couple of years. But we will see.
Yep.
All right. Well, before we get to our next story, I was going to say, Jay, if you remember back when we did ads. Remember that?
Yeah.
A long time ago.
You know, fun.
If we did ads, this is where we do one, but of course we don't anymore. And we made a decision about that, but you know, in the end, you're not a demographic that we want to market to, and we don't want the politics guys to be a vehicle that advertisers can use to convince you that, I don't know, your life would be so much better if you had their stamps or their mattresses or their razors. Yeah.
We're just not shilling for the man.
You know, exactly. But of course, that means we need your support to keep the show going. And we really do appreciate it. All of our great supporters on Patreon. I want to take a minute to thank our two most recent supporters, Julie and Linda. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And of course, when you become a monthly sustaining supporter, you get more than our thanks. All supporters at any level get access to our weekly bonus show. And there are a bunch of other things we put together for supporters at various levels, like, well, special policy shows, politics guys, coffee mugs and tote bags. In fact, Jay, I'm finally going to be sending out the first shipment of mugs and bags to supporters in
awesome.
The next year. I'd meant to get to it earlier. Sorry, guys. It's been a crazy semester, but I'm getting them out this week. I promise. We've got a private Facebook group where we've had some, I think, really great conversations, not just about politics, but about really the direction of the show. And you can even become an executive producer on the show. And so to check out all that stuff, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. It's patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can go to politicsguys.com/support. Thank you so very much. All right, moving on. The Supreme Court, back to the Supreme Court, on Monday, they allowed a class action antitrust suit against Apple to move forward. Now, this was a 5-4 decision, but it was a little unusual because Justice Kavanaugh joined the court's 4 liberals, and it could potentially open the door for similar lawsuits against other tech giants like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, all of whom, by the way, wrote briefs arguing that the court should not allow this case to go forward. Now, this stems from a suit originally filed in 2011, and it alleges that Apple engages in monopolistic practices by forcing device owners to buy through Apple's App Store, where the company takes up to a 30% share of sales commissions for things that actually cost. There are a lot of apps on there that are free as well.
Yeah.
Now, Apple's argument is that according to a previous ruling, only a direct purchaser of a service is eligible to bring this sort of a suit. And Apple says, hey, we're only a middleman. We're just connecting buyers and sellers. And by the way, we're providing quality assurance and security. And because of that, we're entitled to a share of the proceeds. Now, Justice Kavanaugh, who spoke from the bench on this, found this, I would say, unpersuasive. He said that Apple's position contradicts the text of the antitrust statute, which broadly affords any injured party a right to sue. And in his written opinion, Kavanaugh added that the company's argument was a way to gerrymander Apple out of this and similar lawsuits. And so now the case will go back to federal district court. And, you know, it's probably going to likely be a few years at least before there's either a ruling or a settlement. But I think the big thing here is just the very fact that you, according to the court, you can't use this, hey, we're just the middleman argument, you can't sue us, to go forward. And again, this has implications not just for Apple, but to anyone who set up this kind of a service. So, Jay, what do you think about this decision? Which, you know,
this is something that is fascinating because I read the majority opinion, and then I read the dissent, and I sort of found myself agreeing with both of them. Which is hard to do.
So this is a
tough case. And I think this is, this is a case that a lot of people should read just because this is sort of the kind of thing I think the Supreme Court should do, right? This is sort of the operating at its highest and arguing over essentially what the real holding of this Illinois brick case was. In the end, I would probably say Kavanaugh got it right in that. And again, that's sort of, you know, who cares what I say? I'm not in the Supreme Court, but as a
close call,
Jay.
I care.
The idea that on a motion to dismiss you look at this in the view most favorable to the plaintiff. And Kavanaugh sort of says we don't know whether they're actually going to prevail because it could well be that this is a suit where there's no damages.
Right.
Because there is going to be a lot of economic analysis that goes into this, and the plaintiffs would have to show that, you know, they actually, had there been some other kind of competition, they could have purchased, one of these apps for, 35 cents as opposed to 99 cents, or something like that. And I think that's going to be difficult to do.
Which is why, by the way, that class action, this is the point where we'll disagree, which is why I believe class action suits are so important, because that the problem is for any individual, oftentimes the damage will be very limited, and which is why it's not going to be worth any individual's time or money to go ahead and pursue legal action, especially against a very big and well-heeled kind of company, obviously like sure. Apple. They don't get any bigger. But if you bring them together in a class, all of a sudden you can bring to bear that weight and have some sort of a countervailing force and basically force companies to not engage in unfair monopolistic practices.
Yeah. Well, And that's of course the big question though, is this an unfair monopolistic practice? And that's not a question that the court looked at.
Right.
The court only looks at, have they alleged that it's unfair monopolistic? Yeah. And at this stage of the pleadings, you accept that as true.
Yeah.
You know, this argument was essentially overstanding.
It certainly seems to me, Jay, certainly that Apple's position at least is very paternalistic. I mean, I would think the libertarian in you would hear the argument, we're protecting you from bad apps by basically giving you no choice because we don't want you to have a choice because you're going to get stuff that's going to screw up your computer and just be awful. And so trust us as opposed to that. Doesn't that rankle a little bit?
Well, not necessarily, because that's, to me, and I think this is the argument that Apple would make, it's all part of their product. It's all part of their brand. If you're concerned about the choice of in apps that you have, then get an Android.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think that would be the argument, is that, you know, we present a limited front for our platform, because we're trying to protect the image, the brand of that platform.
That's interesting. So you're saying basically that, hey, here we have this lovely curated walled garden here. Yeah. And if you don't like that, well, then you can go to Windows or Linux or Android or whatever, where there's much more openness and choice. That kind of, you know, and I guess on sort of a temperamental level, I like that anarchy choice sort of thing. And so I personally rank.
What if you go to the hardware store and how about this? You ever want to buy a new flag? Right.
Sure, I bought new flags
for the front yard. You're a patriot.
Absolutely.
Well, you will see every single flag will be prominently labeled as made in the USA. Right.
That's right. They pretty much are. Yeah. Nowadays.
As it ought to be. Now I could make the argument that, well, hell, the Chinese could probably make a much cheaper flag that would suit my needs just as well. But I have, you know, because the store has chosen only to sell flags made in America, my choice has been limited. And therefore I'm an antitrust, a victim of monopolistic practices. I think that's sort of the argument that you could also go and say, look, a store has a right to decide what products they're going to sell.
So basically, especially, it's different in the sense because there is in fact an alternative for people, you know, a viable, real alternative. It's not like Apple is, you know, they have like just shy of half of all smartphone sales. And so clearly there's robust competition, at least with one, you know, with one other operating system, Android. So you can kind of go with that. So, yeah, I think that.
And also, you say most of the apps that we're talking about are available for Apple or Android.
Right. Yeah. Now, there are some things.
You know, so there would be some that are only available on one or the other. But yeah,
pretty much, you know, that when that happens, they're only available on Apple. And that's because, you know, that's where the cool kids develop all their stuff first. And we Android people just have to wait for it to kind of filter down to the huddled masses, I guess, that sort of thing. But anyway, you know, another point I wanted to make about this, though, even without a ruling or a favorable settlement, I think this can still be really important because this sort of thing can shift corporate behavior, you know, to an extent. Because if Apple and other companies know that they're even potentially legally vulnerable, they may actually change their behavior to avoid problems in the future. And to me, that's one of the many benefits of, well, strong antitrust law and the ability for people to bring these sort of suits, because it actually, I would argue, prevents certain types of behavior. And so I think this is potentially a good thing in and of itself.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the dissent makes the point, though, that this is that the Illinois brick line, which is that only the direct purchaser has standing, or the direct purchaser has standing to sue,
right,
is sort of artificial. And look, this is where I'm saying Kavanaugh is right, in that when you buy an app from the Apple store, it's like you send your money to Apple and Apple sends you the app. So that you are the direct purchaser from Apple,
right, right,
as opposed to from the manufacturer of the app or the developer. An easy way around this for Apple, it might not be an easy way, but it's certainly a way around it, would be just to change the system, to reconfigure it so that your purchases go through whoever the app developer is.
Right.
And you know, the money does not go to Apple directly, and they could say, we're not going to take a cut of these apps or get a royalty. And you know, that's sort of what our trade-off is from, you know, we might charge people for access to our platform. But I don't think that's not in and of itself a problem.
I think the
minority that points out, look, there's a lot of ways to get around this sort of artificial line if this is the if this is the case. And in a lot of cases, I would say that's probably a less efficient way.
Yeah.
Economically.
Yeah, a lot less. But, I always think of Apple as sort of the Singapore of the technology world. You know, they built up this kind of shiny, beautiful structure, but you know, you have to pretty much play by their rules. And if you don't like that, well, then you know, you're out of luck. Basically, you're kind of into the wilderness of Windows, or if you're really kind of crazy, the Linux world, that sort of thing. Where I've dabbled from time to time. You know, Jay, you know me, Jay. There's kind of my inner anarchist that just wants to just sort of, you know, if I were in Singapore, I'd be so inclined to want to spit on the sidewalk, you know, just because. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, moving on, our final story this week. Late this week, the Trump administration released a new immigration plan, though maybe more of an outline, really, that would significantly change the allocation of permanent residency green cards, but without changing the or lowering the overall cap on the number of green cards that can be granted every year. Now, the proposal would move the system from one that's largely family tie-based to one that more heavily favors education and, you know, potential economic impact that applicants would likely have. Now, everyone knows that this plan is dead on arrival. In fact, both parties have said that, but it's really more of a blueprint for what could happen under different circumstances, more favorable or unfavorable, depending on how you look at it. On the right, it's taken heat for not actually lowering the number of permanent residents, and on the left, for not being comprehensive enough. Now, Jay, my view on this is that we should move to a more skills and education-based policy, but I'd want to see that coupled with a pretty big increase in the cap on green cards. I mean, it's been $675,000 for over 20 years now, and to my view, the basis, of course, for any legislative compromise has to be, you know, compromise. And I don't see this plan offering anything to proponents of increased immigration, which I am one. And so I would say, if, for instance, this is a proposal that a serious proposal would be something like, we're going to shift it to more skills and education, but we're going to raise the cap to, say, 800,000. And we'll build in a series of increases over time, maybe based on something like population growth. And then that would maybe be a more serious legislative proposal, basically. So that's my take. Jay, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you're right as far as where you want to end up. And I again, we're pretty much agreeing on everything this show.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
no,
yeah.
I'm in the same boat as you there. I think we're better off with a merit-based system. And at the same time, we've got more jobs than we have people to fill them. And we are also going to be in a position where we have more Social Security and other entitlement recipients than we have to pay for them. So I think, you know, and our birth rates are low, despite Alabama's efforts. And, I don't think there's any issue, and I think there's quite a number of conservatives who don't have any issue with increased immigration. Their problem is illegal immigration, or this immigration that's not tied to any real rationale other than, well, I've got some other family member here and some other family, and then it's sort of that chain immigration that is problematic. So,
well, you know,
but keep in mind, this is an opening offer, and you wouldn't expect Trump to bid against himself.
Well, right? I mean, and of course, this really isn't an opening offer in the sense it's a campaign document, basically, because it's not, again, Donald Trump has shown no interest in actually negotiating on anything, especially when it comes to details with the other party. But that aside, the one thing that you don't hear talked about a whole lot is there's this immigration cap number. Now, where did it come from? Well, it came from the 1990 Immigration Act. But you know, these are things that I think we need to look at. Don't say, well, here's what the number is. I mean, why is it at that level? And should it be lower or higher? I mean, in 1990.
And I think the 1990 cap, wasn't that an increase over?
Yeah, it was in 1965, the cap was set, the 1965 Immigration Act, the cap was set at 170,000. 1990, they bumped it up to 700,000 from 92 to 94, then 675,000 after that. And so, well, another, I kind of, when I was looking at the history of this, interestingly, at least to me, I always worry about that word interestingly, because I sometimes say it in class and I can picture the students saying, yeah, maybe you think it's interesting, buddy, but I don't. But in the 1952 Immigration Act, they set the cap not at a number, but at 1/6 of 1% of the 1920 U.S. population, which I thought was kind of a weird thing to do. It ended up being a little over 170,000 by my math, at least. But that's kind of I had that idea of, well, it kind of makes sense in a way to kind of peg the cap not to just some arbitrary number, but to take into account population growth and things like that. And I think you and I both agree that Donald Trump's kind of very cavalier statement is, hey, we're full, we can't handle any more people, is obviously a ridiculous thing. And in fact, the job numbers suggest we could use more workers, both skilled and unskilled.
There are a lot of economists who say that's what's really holding us back, is we don't have the workers to fill these jobs.
Absolutely. And so this is one of these areas that it kind of, if we had a president who was less legislatively inept, this would be an area, I would think, where at least potentially we could forge some sort of bipartisan compromise, because there are plenty of people on the right, like you, who would love to see increased legal immigration, you know, and there are plenty of people on the left who would like to see it too. And this just, it just kills me that this is just such, I think, a wasted opportunity here.
Well, here's I think the other issue that you're not looking at. I think you're maybe being a little hopeful that there are those on the left who would be able to, I don't see anyone, I shouldn't say anyone, very few people in the Democrat legislature who would be able to sign on to a merits-based type immigration reform.
Well,
I think ideologically it could not be done.
Well, I disagree. I would say that, for instance, right now, okay, let me give you an example. Right now, family-sponsored immigration is around 70% or so of all, you know, a green card issuance, permanent residency. And that's, I think last year I figures for it's 480,000. So if you just essentially kept that number static and just boosted the total and allowed for much more employment base, which right now is 140,000, then I think you could potentially build some sort of a coalition, get enough people to come over. And again, that's why part of the proposal I would put into place would include increases over time to both of those categories. So, I mean, giving each side something or other. Yeah, I agree with you in the sense that if there was any proposal that basically said we're going to lower in real numbers the amount of family-sponsored immigration, that would be a problem and probably would be really difficult to get any kind of buy-in. But I think there are ways to kind of work around that and give both parties, you know, something that they want. So maybe optimistic.
Maybe. I think I still think there would be a difficult, any, even the very argument. And I bet we will get all sorts of hate mail on this, on the idea of merit-based immigration.
You think?
I think there is going to be the open borders folks.
Who are those people? I hear about those people a lot, but I don't actually know any of those people. I feel like they're like these kind of these mythical creatures, essentially. I mean, you know, Donald Trump tweeting that, oh, the Democrats want open borders and crime and chaos. And it's like, well, I don't know of any Democrats who are actually running on that.
This was interesting. This was pictures that I saw. It was actually at an art gallery, but it was pictures from demonstration in downtown Cleveland, you know, against Trump and for immigration. But there was someone, you know, not someone, a lot of people, holding signs that said deportation is immoral. And I thought, well, okay, then what's your alternative?
Sure, right? I mean,
if that's where you are, that it is an immoral act to deport, to get someone out of the country, then you are necessarily open borders. Anybody who wants to come here can stay here, right? Because I'd assume they wouldn't be for detention or execution. So I mean, well, I think it's sort of...
I see what you're saying, but I would disagree. I would say that, you know, given the limited space on these placards, if you actually talk to some of these people, they wouldn't say, they would say, well, you know, under, what about under this circumstance? They say, well, right, yeah, that makes sense. But I don't think we should send back somebody who did nothing wrong, who's in danger of being, you know, persecuted in their home country. That's what I mean.
And that's the current law.
Right. But how do you, but I mean, certainly there are some people like who have been in the United States and have been law-abiding contributors to society. And there have been, you know, cases of this that have been, you know, featured in the media. They've been deported. And I think that's what the people who say deportation is immoral are talking about. But I think it's a bad idea to base policy on what some protester has on their piece of cardboard. I think that's probably a mistake.
Ask me where these people were. I'm telling you.
Okay, that's fair. You're right. I did ask you where these people were.
I'm just telling you.
Fair enough. I just don't think these people are making
Cleveland with these big signs.
Fair enough. Just like there are neo-Nazis running around with their own signs and thankfully they're not the ones making policy. So there we go. All right. Well, on the neo-Nazi note, why don't we end things there? It's always good to end things on a neo-Nazi note, I would guess, but we're not entirely ending things because of course, if you are a Patreon supporter, we have the bonus show we're going to be doing in just a minute. And this week, I think Jay and I are going to be talking about that facial recognition ban in San Francisco and the latest entrance into the Democratic presidential sweepstakes, whatever you want to call it now. It's practically like a sweepstakes. Seems like everyone's entering. And so if you are a supporter, you should have that in your podcast feed by the time you hear that. And if you're not, of course, you can go to Patreon or patreon.com/politicsguys and there you go. You can become a supporter. So that does it for this week. And again, if you have a question, comment, correction, just, you know, want to reach out and say hi, you can do that. mail@politicsguys.com. There's also our Facebook page where you can message us when we post stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguys page. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. And if you haven't already subscribed to the show, we really would appreciate it. That helps us out a lot. And word of mouth, telling us, we know about the show, but telling people who don't know about the show, that would also be very helpful, as would leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, and Benji Fishman. Today's show is produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.